Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need.
Marketing wizards?
Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Joel Morris.
I'm not paying attention. I'm Jason Hazley. I'm paying attention now, sorry.
And as usual, we're joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. By taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works, or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we're finished. Both approaches are valid. Our special guest today is the lovely Simon Evans.
Thank you very much.
Hello.
Hello, Simon.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
We've just been clearing our passages before we start.
We have, blowing out the ambiguity. I was just saying, I'm a 54, and I've only really quite recently learned how to really snore. I mean, I could occasionally give off the odd snort, but I've started waking myself up recently, and you seem to be able to access a reservoir of mucus which I've previously been oblivious to. I assumed at first that I was developing a cold, but it's not. It's just always there, and it's just been waiting. Yeah,
this is background mucus, like background radiation.
Yes, exactly.
I wonder if any medical people...
I don't know if it's used mucus from previous, you know, that it's already been used to clean out my nose or other passages.
Isn't it,
you know.
Isn't it that every piece of mucus you've got has been previously sneezed by Alexander the Great?
Yes,
Julius Caesar. It's a cycle.
And a London rat.
Yeah. And it contains a certain amount of cocaine.
Is that, yes.
I wonder whether you...
That probably is true.
Do you think your pipes kind of loosen up as you get older or something?
Well,
I wonder, there must be a reason.
What definitely does
it.
Happen is I think that the jaw recedes more, because the cure for snoring I've discovered, because I sent off for one, is a sort of thing that looks like a... It looks like computer representation of a set of dentures, you
right.
know, but just transparent. Well, a bit like a gum shield that you
yes.
bite into when it's warm, and then it sets around your mouth. And you wear it, and then you click the bottom mandible forward, and that you feel like a Habsburg, basically, from then on.
Oh,
and,
so, like, my
And then
my
you can't snore. If you like that with your... You're this more...
I've
that's
got,
actually just a fair amount of chin.
Well, no,
I've got
a thing called a class 3 bite where
the
bottom teeth are ahead of the top teeth, because
right.
I had an accident when I was a kid and it smashed my
Does
face
Does that crop
pieces.
Up on police descriptions of you?
I
see one male, class 3 bite.
You can be identified by your dental records if I kill you. That's quite good.
Especially yes. if you manage to take a chunk out of his arm before he does so. Yeah. But that's how it does. So I don't know whether maybe you'll never snore. I don't know. But no. And I can actually do it. It's quite uncomfortable, the snoring mechanism, the anti-snoring mechanisms.
Oof.
You don't want to really have it in all night. And
it's
you
like
do
wearing
wake
a retainer
up with a certain amount of, yes, exactly, yeah.
Oof.
But, you know, some nights it really genuinely wakes me up, you know, my own, because I've quite a, you know, and even with plugs in, obviously there's the internal.
Yeah.
So, yeah, going to have my ears triple glazed on the inside as well.
You can't get away from your internal
you
reverberations,
really can.
Can you?
When your own ear, nose and throat tract is home to the sound that's making
your inner. Is it like hearing situation. Your own voice on tape? No one likes to hear their own snore.
No, that's right.
It's really embarrassing.
They do. That's another system for curing it that is available. Something that plays it back to you into your own ears, but with a slight kind of gap or something. I think.
So like noise cancelling headphones.
Yes. Yes.
But snoring.
Yeah.
I remember, I don't snore that much, but that thing of just having something in your mouth that's uncomfortable, I'd fear having to have a snoring thing. Because I remember I had a retainer, orthodontic thing, like a lot of people did of my generation.
Shows your teeth?
Because I've only got 28 teeth, because that take loads out. So remarkable, I've got a very small
mouth.
How many
are you supposed to have?
32, isn't it?
Is it?
Yeah, I've got four taken out to fit the adult jaw. And I remember that happening, being given this thing that went to my mouth. Right?
Yes.
At exactly the point I was at my most self-conscious. Right, okay, now in front of other people at school, when you're just trying to find a place, we would like... this will do wonders for your development. And it was a really cruel thing to do to teenagers, to stuff something in their mouth. To stop them communicating.
You see, it's an interesting, you know, people always say to stand-up, so were you the class clown? And to somebody who's made their career writing comedy, so were you the class clown but crippled by...
Had to write it down.
Yeah. It was
like, had to express yourself entirely through words. Yeah, but it was a really cruel thing. When you're self-conscious, the number of things that happened to you at that age, we're going to talk about something teenage today.
Yes.
You sort of saying, like, stuffing things in your mouth. I remember that being a really primal thing that at the moment I went... Hey, I think I've got this. I'm growing up. I'm getting taller. And they went, we're going to stuff something to stop you communicating.
Yeah.
It's a really weird thing.
It was gummed up with food, didn't it, as well? Mine was a plate with wires on it that I had on my top set of teeth. And it was there to drag my top set of teeth forward, which didn't work, as you can tell, because I've just told you, to bottom
three,
set or ahead.
Classic,
all it did was just left me in pain for about 3 years, because it just really fucking hurt.
Yeah.
Really hurt.
Well, I didn't have one, but my daughter has a retainer set at the moment. Maybe I'm getting some insight into why she's so bloody grumpy all the time.
I imagine, like most dental things, it's better than the ones we had. Yeah, basically, you look at them, it's like you look back on it, it's a bit like.
Was yours Bluetooth?
No, it felt more like sort of battlefield medicine. It's those things like go and see the cutty sark.
Well, until the Crimean War, of course, most soldiers were expected just to sort of commandeer their own teeth, essentially.
Yeah. it's not that brutality. I remember avoiding going to the dentist for ages. Having all those gaps in your, I think it was 30 to 40, going, I just don't want to go to the dentist. If I don't go, my teeth will be fine. Yeah. And then going back and finding out, like you do when you get a new car, that it's completely changed. I turned up and went, this is going to be the most frightening thing in the world. And the technology has leapt forwards.
Yeah.
And the jab doesn't hurt and the dentist does it in 2 seconds. Everything has changed because you opted out of it for a bit.
And the big thing, the big change, because I didn't go to the dentist for a shameful 27 years, I think. I avoided going to the dentist.
And after they categorised your jaw.
After they spent years rebuilding my mouth, and it was just so traumatic, and I just ran away.
Yeah.
But the big thing I noticed when I went back to the dentist is that the pink drink is green.
Wow.
Whoa. It's gone green.
I hadn't noticed that. Yeah. No, that's still pink where I am.
But
I'm still NHS. Are you NHS?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hello and welcome to Rule of Teeth.
Yeah. It is all sorts of teeing up the...
It is. I think we're talking about like social embarrassment and things. We'll talk about red hands later on.
Yeah.
We were delighted. By the way, you mentioned this, I think, in passing on Twitter. And we suddenly thought, oh, my God, we have to get you in to talk about
this. To a grandchild, I think.
His daughter, I think.
Was it his daughter?
Yes,
right. Okay.
I think.
You were nattering about it and just said, in passing, Jack Rosenthal, what a hero. And we just piled on because he's a huge hero of ours. And then thought, well, we have to do some.
Yes.
So thank you for even mentioning him. I don't think it occurred to us that either that we would do it on here or we'd find another fan.
No, you wouldn't automatically put him into the pure comedy bracket, I suppose, would you? Although it's the comedy in it that lifts it above the rest of 1970s and 80s television standalone play output, I would say, by and large. You know,
apart from
the Le Frenet and Clement...
But it's
sorry, you made them sound like a wine.
I know.
I now want a bottle of Clément Le Frenet.
But it pairs beautifully with a cold porridge.
But he sits between, Jack Rosenthal sits between the sitcom people.
Yeah.
Here you go, Clément Le Frenet and things. Who did comedy dramas like Alfie de Zane Pett and things and would do single plays and things. They did. Rosenthal sits there between that and the Bleasdale, Dennis Potter, Wednesday play people. And I have always claimed him for the comedy side because he's got a Victoria Woody kind of Alan Bennett-y tone to him.
Yeah.
But then you look at his output and you go, he's part of the single play, the serious television dramatist.
He was sort of, I mean, if it was portraits, there's a little bit of a sort of Norman Rockwell about him, isn't there? That it's comedic, almost like a fully evolved newspaper cartoon. And yet when you look back 100 years ago, those are the pictures that tell you something about the time, much more than Jasper Johns or something would be, you know, as a... as an expression of what was actually happening in the society at that time. So I think his intention was comedic, but his eye was just so good he couldn't help, you know, taking beautiful snapshots as well.
Well, he was described in Philip Purser's obit in The Guardian as the Charles Dickens of television. And I think that's a very good tone for him, because Dickens is comic and dramatic and regarded as the greatest novelist and the portraitist of his era.
Yes.
And there's what's happened strangely since Jack Rosenthal is a divide in comedy and drama that keeps being attempted to be crossed back over in a quite clumsy way, when actually what Rosenthal sings to is the thing of saying these are totally integrated.
It's interesting, the Dickens thing, isn't it? Because that's one of those... I mean, that was always... He's like the... In the same way that during the 80s, everyone wanted to be the Letterman, the British Letterman, you know, and then, like, in television, everyone wants to be the new Dickens, but never, you know, it was always the new Dylan. Springsteen was the new Dylan, and it's, everyone has that period if you're slightly too poetic in your lyrical intent, you know, sort of, if your rhymes run over the end of a line, then you're always the new Dylan. But I'm not sure about... For me, I love Dickens, perhaps slightly more in principle than in reality. I've probably actually only read three books, but I'm a massive fan in principle, you know, yeah. And every time I do read it, I think it's tremendous. But he was really lurid, grotesque caricatures, wasn't it? I mean, that was...
Yeah.
I read Bleak House quite recently, and even that, which is one of the more serious ones, I think, nevertheless, you know, everyone is, like, defined by quite monstrous characteristics. Rosenthal is much more nuanced.
Miniatures,
exactly. Yeah. He's more in tune with an Alan Bennett kind of sensibility. In that respect,
he doesn't really write grotesques, does he?
I don't think so.
Not
no.
at all.
They might, one or two of them might appear to be, and then they're humanised a little bit.
He's got too much empathy,
track.
I think. Yeah. I mean, he's very human. His background, he started out writing Coronation Street, 129 episodes of Coronation Street. He wrote Coronation Street episode 31.
Wow.
Which you're in right at the ground floor.
He went to
Tony
Warren.
I wonder
if he felt he was in at the ground floor at 31. I thought, damn,
I missed the classic
30.
Years. missed the classic hips. But yeah, he wrote Tony Warren's I'd Like to Have a Go, and he ended up writing 129 of these, and that's a very good way of, I mean, soap training. Yeah. Especially if something as good as Coronation Street was, is a great way of being sympathetic to characters.
And that was comedic. I believe it still is. I don't watch it now. Is it still on now?
It still runs. And it's always the funniest.
It was a massive class divider. My nan used to watch Coronation Street, and it was an embarrassment to my newly lower middle class parents.
I think one of the characters he wrote in there was, I don't know, I'm not a huge Corrie fan, but Arthur Lowe had a part in that.
Did he really?
He developed a very, very good character for Arthur Lowe in Coronation Street.
Speaking with a Northern accent.
That he then spun off into a sitcom.
Oh.
And that sitcom, where he was a slightly pompous man, was the thing that probably got him the Dad's Army gig.
Right.
So Rosenthal developed a character for Arthur Lowe that then went off to basically set one of the standards for British sitcom.
Yeah.
So he's got this crossover into comedy, but he's definitely a drama writer.
I think saying he's the Coronation Street of standalone plays. I mean, that works. You don't need to recommend Dickens at that point. You know, you've shaken off that.
And the play you've chosen to bring in is one that's really, really close to me and Jason, definitely. It's one of the things, one of the earliest VHSs I wrote on the side, I think.
Yeah. I think, you know, I very often catch myself on this podcast by sheer fortune saying, oh, this is my favourite thing that so-and-so has done, or I absolutely love this program. But I have to say, this film I love with my whole heart. I've always absolutely loved it. It made such a big impression on me when I saw it.
Yeah.
And I could watch it again and again, and I have, and it is
Patang Yang Kipper Bang. The sort of indifference with which you have to utter the final grunt.
Yeah.
It was slightly modulated throughout the show, slightly different. It would always reflect the mood slightly.
Yeah.
It could be given up grudgingly or enthusiastically, but never with real jubilant triumphalism.
It was always a job. It's one of those catchphrases that's become like a chore.
Can you imagine getting anything away today with the title Patang Yang Kipper Bang, by the way? Let's go from the front, shall we?
It would be called The School Children.
Well, it would be investigated, I suppose, wouldn't it? It would be inspected and scrutinised. And I suppose if you were to investigate it and scrutinise it as a schoolboy, potentially you might find something there. I don't know.
Well, there's something like, it reminded me of, isn't it?
In Kipper Bang, at least.
yes, I suppose so. It's a bit sort of Four of Fish and Finger Pie.
Exactly,
There's another great school drama called Unman, Wittering and Zygo, isn't there? There's something about doing school stuff, because what you're basically saying is, it's just about life. That in order to make it seem a bit more exotic, you think of a really weird, fascinating title for it that makes it sound like a detective series. Or this sounds like, I don't know, something set in Middle Earth or something.
Yes.
Weirdly, I remember it drawing me in and thinking, what's that thing? Because you've heard the title, you've seen it on the listings and the TV Times, whatever, and it would make you watch it probably more than... First Love is the title of the whole series. If it had just been called First Love, I probably wouldn't have seen it.
Oh, was it? Playwrights.
He was the script editor of a thing called First Love that was Channel 4, the first drama commission that Channel 4 did. This was night two of Channel 4 in 1982. This went out as, I imagine, the first one of a series of plays about First Love.
Oh, I didn't remember that. That's interesting. Mm. I mean, that's the sort of thing I was worried I wouldn't know when I came here, because I know that you've had this kind of hinterland.
I've been to Wikipedia.
But that is interesting, because I remember watching it with my mother and father, and they were very enthusiastic. My father loved it as well, and I always enjoyed watching anything that we both laughed at the same time as it, and that sort of thing. And it's quite interesting. I think we would have seen the play title would certainly have leapt out at us. The seeing that it was written by Jack Rosenthal would have been an immediate confirmation that we were on safe ground.
Yep.
But I think that would have helped us cross over to Channel 4, because I think there was some suspicion about Channel 4 in our household in exactly the same way that there previously had been about Coronation Street.
Yeah.
You know, there was a little bit of... You know, I didn't necessarily have the lefty sort of pornographer of the nation slander attached to it yet. But
it was unknown and it was the youngster, so it could well have been the first pierced channel.
Exactly. Whereas, in fact, it couldn't have been more reassuring, could it? As content. I mean, that's the thing. It is entirely lovable, and yet it could quite easily have been quite dated, because obviously it was a bit like a Happy Days thing in itself anyway.
Yeah.
It was. I remember, I don't know if this makes sense to you, but I remember watching Happy Days with mates, really confused as to whether this was set now and this is what America was like now, or is this, why is this, like, is Greece an old, yeah, exactly, like, yeah.
Greece is a 1970s disco version of the 50s.
Exactly.
Yeah. Aren't the Bee Gees in Greece?
And Olivia Newton-John, who's clearly a 30-year-old Australian woman.
One of the great advantages, one of the joys of this, and there are a lot of school dramas around the time, other ones that I love, like Dutch Girls by William Boyd is a wonderful...
Oh, it's great, isn't it?
What this has got in common with something like Gregory's Girl is that they cast it to the right age.
Yes.
From the moment you first see the lead character's face, you go, oh, my God, he's 14. And I think the girl who's the love interest is 13 or 14. They are exactly the right age. And it makes it a very different thing than Please, Sir.
Well, the only other one that I immediately thought of when it came back on, and I'd forgotten that I remembered at the time that I associated it with this, was Swalk, which was a movie with Jack Wilde, most famously, but also Mark Lester. And I can't remember the name of the girl, which is dreadful of me. They were the two on which I kind of tragically created my template for teenage romance, you know. I decided to be thwarted in exactly that manner, you know.
But, this is how heroically to fail.
But I felt I did, you know, I genuinely registered that kind of level of association and, you know, you entered the character at that point.
It's got a lot in common with Gregory's Girl. It would make a really nice little double bill. It's got a nice Bill Forsythe understanding of it. But it's set, like you said, like Happy Days, in 1948. It's set in Rosenthal's actual childhood.
Yeah.
And the period detail is really nice. It's quite lightly worn. I read a horrible review in Time Out, which I'll read bits of as we go through this. Time Out, who I used to have a policy of, if Time Out didn't like something, I'd go and see it. And it says, a flimsy premise, an all too easily nostalgic movie, whose production values and period detail are overstated to the point of cliche.
Is this in a recent Time Out film guide?
If you look up this on the Time Out website, that's the review they're happy with.
Wow.
And I couldn't disagree more.
Hang on a second. Production values. This is produced by David Leland and directed by Michael Apted who directed 7-Up and all the other ups.
Yeah.
They're complaining about the production values. How fucking dare they?
It is a beautiful film. It's all on film.
Yep.
So one of the lovely things, if you're watching an old play, one of the big advantages, if it's all on film, you will not go, oh, God, they're in a studio. It's got a lovely... plangent soft focus that's perfect for teenage nostalgia, and it's about first love, so it needs to be shot like this. But those close-ups of the child's face, and everyone is achingly soft.
And everything I saw, I mean, having watched it again in preparation for this and bought the DVD, but I don't think I'd seen it in years, and I don't think we had a VHS copy, and yet it felt like I'd previously watched it the previous week. It was immediately so present there.
Yep.
I think that's a pretty good sign about production values and things, that you remember every scene and every little, and you go, oh God, yes, I'd forgotten this bit, but as soon as you see it.
I'm doing double Cicero with hand farting or something. I knew that was there somewhere. I'd forgotten that for about 10 years, I used to regularly say bloody hell and scrotum, which is exactly from this script, isn't it?
I remember Alison Steadman shouting beasts of the field.
It's got that lovely turn of phrase. One of the things that's really interesting about Jack Rosenthal, he is a comedy writer, and he writes comedy, he writes funny dialogue. And this opens with the mum calling up to the kid what he's going to have for breakfast because he's stopped eating, which is a lovely little subtext. But obviously, he's pining away for this girl. He stopped eating. And there's that lovely line.
A few cornflakes wouldn't hurt you.
I know Thursdays are difficult for you, but with the girls having double domestic science while we're on double PT. But if just somehow, I don't think I can last out another day.
If I made you fresh air on toast, would you eat the toast?
If I made you fresh air on toast, would you eat the toast? But it's shouted up the stairs, so you have to concentrate to hear it. Yeah. It's not front and centre funny lines.
It's almost like a Beano strip in which little speech bubbles are intruding from people who aren't going to appear, isn't it? It's not very like a Beano strip.
It's not on the front foot. He allows it, he allows the comic dialogue very often to be little passing notes rather than a gag. They're not the end of a line. They're not. Yeah. They're not the finish. They're flavours on the way somewhere. And when you read his scripts on the page, I was reading a couple of them in preparation for this. They're not full of great lines, but they're full of space in which a great actor will be able to get a laugh, which is really, really clever to know that you're going to cast this well.
Brackets goes business here.
Yeah. The big thing with this is, unlike when you read a comic script or an observationally comic script by a new writer, they're very often very keen to show off.
Yeah.
And this is a play, like most of his stuff, written by someone who's written 250 plays. He's got his reputation. He can let it sit back. And it gives it that lovely comedy drama feel. It gives it a realism because people do talk like this.
The structure is always very, very sound, isn't it? And I did notice one of the other ones I watched again in preparation was Another Sunday in Sweet F.A., which has a similarity in this respect, that Another Sunday in Sweet F.A. is about an ex-footballer who never quite achieved his dreams and is now a Sunday League ref. And he is just on the other side, I suppose, of virile manhood in the same sense that our young lad in Patangyang is sort of approaching it. So they're both men who are sort of shut out slightly from the rude world of the sort of boisterous changing room and so on. But it starts in exactly the same way. He is actually leaving his house on Sunday morning and his wife is calling to him as he sort of buckles up his briefcase and there is a couple of lads having a scrap and they've sort of rolled into his front garden. And he's what it seems to suggest in both cases to me is that our main protagonist is a bit of a dreamer and there are voices of reality and pragmatism constantly hectoring and sort of attempting to sort of penetrate
very
his Billy mental
Lyle.
World.
Very Waterhouse and Hall.
Yeah, yeah. And so you immediately feel a sort of tenderness for this young soul or this ageing soul who isn't quite made for the brutal world.
Mother, I'm not a child.
Can you best and shorts?
Mother, I'm 14.
Pound to a penny you didn't blanco your plimsolls.
He likes writing people leaving their house at the front of the day.
Yes,
watch Ready When You Are, Mr. McGill. Yeah, right. That opens with the guy who is the extra, just learning his lines in bed, then leaving his house. You
Well, I suppose it's Route One, isn't it? It's there and back again. It's The Hobbit, isn't it?
But it's very like the opening of Billy Liar is almost analogous to this, isn't it? Yeah. It's young boy in bed fantasizing. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. While his mum downstairs shouts for him.
You've got a vulnerable
dreamer. Promising
he
won't wank if he can just have a kiss.
Yes.
Dear God, he's talking to God. I kept forgetting how many lovely devices there are in this, even down to the kids having their own language, like Patang and Kippenbang. There's all these ideas in it that are very authentic. One of them is him lying in bed talking to God, interspersed with the commentary of John Arlott.
Yes.
Which, in my mind, I think, remembering, I'd got them mixed up, and I thought, bizarrely, that John Arlott was God. But they are blurred.
Well,
there's an all-seeing narrator, which is... There's a lovely moment where John Arlott is commentating, because he's a big cricket fan, and he's commentating, and he's using real cricketers' names, and it's real Bradman, and everyone's in there.
Spencer then snatches the ball out of the air from Evans' throw, polishes it on that not inconsiderable chest of his and prepares this giant of a man to bowl yet again to Don Bradman. And with Bradman 63 and Australia dismaying 235 for one, here he comes. Gathering pace, gathering strength, pounding, pounding powerfully up to the wicket, and he bowls. And Bradman yet again hooks him convulsively for four. And Bedser's shoulders drooping, grimaces philosophically at no one in particular.
And then at a point about two-thirds of the way through, a third of the way through, he mentions the kid's name, Duckworth, Quack Quack Duckworth.
Yes.
And you realise it's not a sample of John Arlott.
No,
it's really John Arlott.
Yes. John Arlott.
Which is just, oh, it's as magic as finding out that Michael Caine wasn't sampled on the Marked Madness song.
13-year-old lad, and he's got the weight of the nation's expectations on his shoulders.
Oh, it's gorgeous. But there's this voice that booms over it all.
Yeah.
The whole theme of the thing is about, as you said, it's about going into adulthood. What kind of a man are you going to be? Are you going to be a man? What sort of a body are you going to grow into? It's all about... It literally is a coming-of-age drama.
Yes.
Probably one of the most on-the-nose coming-of-age dramas.
Well, the scales fall from his eyes in two respects, don't they? One, in terms of his interaction with the girl, which is the main one, but also the man he set up as a sort of hero.
The superhero. Sorts,
Tommy the Groundsman.
But that's where John Arlott fits in, because he's got these heroes, and they are war heroes, and they are sporting heroes, exactly like a boy who read The Victor or The Magnet would have had. He's got these 1940s post-war baby boomer heroes. And during the run of the play, his expectations of those get dented. But the voice at the beginning says, you want to be the sort of man who John Arlott will talk about.
Yeah.
This is the dream, that you would be so heroic that even John Arlott would know who you were. And that's in his head. And then added to that is his relationship with the groundskeeper, where this guy is the guy... I love the constant list of the places that the groundskeeper says he's fought at.
So what you and all the other Tommies did, what you all did with our gallant allies and comrades across the seas and Commonwealth and that, facing the foe in whatever theatres of human conflict at... where was it?
Where was what?
The theatres of human conflict. You know, where you fought.
Oh, Dunkirk, El Alamein, Battle of the Bulge in Burma.
Dunkirk, El Alamein, the Battle of the Bulge in Burma. What you did was not just defeat Hitler's Germany and Japan's... Japan. I mean, let's face it, you changed the future of the world.
Look, watch your toes, you're on my way a bit.
Sorry.
Yes. You got it, Dunkirk, El Alamein, Battle of the Bulge in Burma.
Yeah.
The most incredible tour of duty.
It should have triggered some alarm bells, but I suppose for a 40-year-old boy.
But those clues are there, and his relationship with that guy who is his hero and he loves, and the guy is clearly broken for some secret reason. And you talked about structure. This is a beautifully structured thing. There's an A plot, a B plot, and a C plot, and they just run. There's I Want to Kiss the Girl. There's what's going on with the teacher and her sex life.
Yeah.
And who is this guy and what's his secret?
Yeah.
A, B and C, pure sitcom, played over an hour and 17
Plus,
minutes.
Plus, a thing that Rosenthal does again and again and again in his writing, a Greek chorus, which in this case is the two guys digging the road.
Yes.
He loves putting a Greek chorus in.
They're so great, aren't they?
They're brilliant,
popping
aren't
his little head up. They're literally in a hole and they stick their little heads up.
Yeah.
Like sort of almost animal kind of like...
Yeah,
kind of
Statler
like
and Waldorf.
Kind of,
one of them's a guy from The Bill, isn't it?
Yeah.
I can't remember the actor's name.
Right. Eric Thingy. And he pops his head up and says, I blame...
very lean.
I blame Dickie Valentine.
He's had a bad war.
Bloody hellfire and scrotums.
Millions of pounds on education.
Oh. It'll be with him living under the shadow of the bomb, I expect.
And he's got a thing which he does again in Ready When You Are, Mr. McGill, where he's got his Greek chorus are rude mechanicals. There's a Shakespearean people who are proper labourers. So there's a wild fantasist, like, for instance, the film crew in Ready When You Are, Mr. McGill, who are doing something silly or whatever. And there are working men, like the removal men in The Chain, who commentate on it from a point of view of a different class. And they're looking, I mean, this kid's a grammar school kid, it's quite a nice school.
Yeah.
And so you go, well, he's sort of affluent, lower middle to middle class to upper middle class. And there are people watching him going, what a life this pampered fop is living. Exactly like the decorator.
Good contrast in a way, because the men in the hole are an actual chorus. To which the boy is oblivious.
Yes.
While he's got John Arlott in his head, providing this, like, imagined chorus.
Less critical.
And here comes the 30, and he's like, meanwhile, they're actually looking at him, what the hell is he? Yes, he tries to bowl a ball at the beginning, doesn't he, and sends his papers everywhere. He's totally lost in it. But
The two young actors, John Albacini and Abigail Crutenden, they photograph so well, don't they? They just look fantastic.
Abigail's really beautiful. She knows she's in Not Going Out now.
Is she?
You know that. You know it's also Hal Crutenden's sister.
I knew it was Hal's sister,
She's been in the last four series, I think, of Not Going Out, which I write for, so I've sort of kept an eye on it, which they are married and still not going out and have children. So she's married to Hugh Dennis, Abigail Crutenden now, which is kind of... I did sort of think, is that them growing up?
Yeah. Well, John Albacini, who plays Quack, plays Alan.
Yes.
I looked up finding the rest of his credits, and charmingly, he has kept working.
He's
still a bit of an actor. My favourite favourite role for him. He's the helicopter pilot in The World Is Not Enough, the Pierce Brosnan James Bond film directed by Michael Apted.
No.
Oh,
wow. Bless him, phoned him back and said, do you want to be in a Bond film? Like the ultimate thing that Quack Quack would have dreamt of.
Absolutely.
He gets to be a pilot in a Bond film.
And here he is, the 48-year-old lad.
Piloting his helicopter with Pierce Brosnan in black.
That was, I suppose, I had a tiny criticism of. Her character is, I suppose, enigmatic, slightly sort of Garbo-esque, that you want to put, even as a schoolboy, you project your own thoughts onto her. It was a slightly odd denouement, how she reacts to not being kissed on stage.
I love that, in that he has put her on a pedestal throughout.
Yeah.
And then when he decides he can't kiss her, I mean, structurally, if you haven't seen this play, the structure is there are three moments he could kiss her. And they get tenser and tenser. Things keep getting in the way of a kiss at the school play where he is scripted to kiss her, the one thing he wants to do. He has to, at some point, on the instructions of his strict teacher, give her a kiss, the one thing he wants.
And then rain stops play each time.
Each time he's thwarted at that moment.
The fact that he's actually named after a system for applying scores to a cricket match in which rain has stopped play. I don't think that was accidental. But
so he's... The crucial points are, is he going to kiss her? And he doesn't kiss her at the last moment. He shakes her hand. Watching it, I'd forgotten what happened.
Having, of course, you've watched him you've watched snatches and vignettes from the final Triumph and production in which his acting is tremendous. And he delivers a couple of lines really well.
So he's going really well. He could do
it. He's motoring
at this
point. But
he shakes her hand, which is a lovely moment. It's very, very funny. And also, he has said before, the thing he's most insecure about is he's got red hands, sweaty hands.
So he's
even prepared to put his sweaty hands, rather than kiss her, he's prepared to embarrass himself. He does it in front of the whole school, staring at him. He has performance anxiety. And he shakes her hand. And then her reaction is beautiful because she's not the cheerleader. None of the other boys fancy her. She is the subject of his fascination. Weirdly, I think she's almost too beautiful in this to sell convincingly as someone who's a weird crush for him.
Yeah.
But when she is revealed in her character, she chases after him. Why did you do that? Suddenly she's alive and you go, she was way more complicated and interesting than you gave her credit for.
Why didn't you want to kiss me? Am I that grotesque? To the nth degree?
She wasn't just on a pedestal. She had her own opinions, and suddenly she's got her own voice. He earns her love by rejecting it. And she suddenly goes, well, why? Because you look like you...
Am I grotesque to the nth degree,
she asks. She suddenly... You realise that all the way through this, she was hurt and thought she was being rejected and was... Because she's been flirting with the good-looking boy in the class, the heartthrob of 4B. Jeffrey, the heartthrob of 4B. You think that she thinks she's of that standard. But actually, she realised that she doesn't think she's of that standard. She's got the same anxieties as he's got. And... She's not revealed to be that person until the moment the entire Schrödinger's edifice collapses.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a perfectly reasonable explanation. And I think, if I'm honest, at the moment when it happened, I thought it was very funny that he shook hands with her, but I thought her reaction was... I just remember some girls like that, and that's not how they would have reacted if I had refused to kiss them. They were like, well, fuck you then, heavens, and go back to...
The deeper of the female characters is the one played by Frances Raphael. Who's the girl who will let everyone hug her.
Yes.
She was, of course, UK Eurovision entry 1994, Frances Raphael.
Of course, yes.
As we all know.
She was in Les Mis as well, wasn't she? I think she played the lead in Les Mis.
Lots of stage...
That's where the beat of the field thing comes in,
isn't
it?
Yeah, they're hugging her.
That would be very close to the scene.
Stop hugging her!
I think my favourite character in it, Alison Steadman, really, but then she is usually in things that she's in. I mean, it's almost tiresome, but she's very young at this point.
She's not showy.
No.
Out! All of you! All of you! Out! Wilt! Beast of the field! Out!
Why, I just keep...
Not you, beast of the field!
The scene after, I think the single best acted scene in it and best most perfectly realised is the one after Alison Steadman has discovered she's not pregnant.
Yes.
And there's the scene when she discovers she's not pregnant, when she's sitting there directing them in the theatre, and then she feels a movement between her legs and she realises that she's having her period, which is a tiny bit eggy, possibly, but anyway, nevertheless...
It's done very well.
It was done as tastefully as you possibly can, up with the face,
I think when I first saw it, I didn't read that scene properly.
I wasn't sure what was going on at
But then
at
I'd
my
have been
age.
13 or something. Yeah, exactly.
It's a coming-of-age film in many
but
ways.
But the scene after she's broken the news to the groundsman and is now... restored to her vigorous, confident self and is rehearsing the scene, the play with them the following evening. The sort of poise and alacrity and energy and happiness and vibrancy and optimism that she's been reborn with, realizing that her life is not in shreds after all. She's just incredible. She just has this kind of briskness, which is just like exactly what a woman who has been given that reprieve in 1948 would have had.
Very good. Whereupon, you dismiss him with a confident smile. A confident one, Duckworth. Do you know how to be confident? I think the author would like it. Is that it? I see. Well, the author will have to be disappointed. Consider yourself dismissed, Whittaker, with a confident smile. Continue, Duckworth.
It's a transformative moment. Yeah. Maybe what you're watching there is both the two big female leads are having a moment where they shift gear.
Yes.
And Alison Steadman's is done masterfully, as you'd expect from Alison Steadman. And Abigail Crutton is done with the inexperience of a 13 or 14-year-old, being asked to do what is a very difficult thing. One thing, and then, because of events, be another thing.
I remained completely in love with her anyway, definitely at 13. it was almost a swoop moment. But
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This school, it's filmed at Wimbledon Chase Primary School, which Ofsted says is outstanding, which is good news. It's a state school. But I looked it up, and a quarter of 1948 grammar schools were co-ed, which I didn't realise. I thought it was very much a boys and girls thing.
Yeah.
So this is a very good depiction of what it would have felt like at the time to
was
be
authentic.
Thrusting, because co-education was a fairly newish thing,
yeah.
into a
yeah.
situation where your teenage would happen in parallel. And I think one of the things that makes this wonderful is its specificity of detail and time.
Yeah.
And when you see a teen film that hasn't got that, it's always disappointing because all teenage emotions are pretty much general. But what nails it is the references to Dickie Valentine and the cricketers and things that puts it exactly in the class and in the time that it's in. So you know what everyone will behave like. You know what disgrace would befall the teacher if she had the groundsman's baby. All those rules are in place. And I think with to any team movie, John Hughes or anything, clarity of what are the consequences, what's at stake, why are you behaving in such a repressed way around something which is purely natural. I think that's what really stands this up.
The scene, you mentioned it glancingly earlier, where that one of the girls makes herself available for a quick hug, but literally just like a sort of grind, like left, right and off.
No hands involved. Yeah, he was leaning against each other.
And they're in a row, but that feels a completely plausible way for them to diffuse the tension that would otherwise exist in that situation.
That sort of thing is why I think it's joyous, is you know how this is going to play out. You said you relate it to your school and your experiences, but it's clearly about his experiences.
Yeah.
There's a truth to it, but also a specificity. And I think that's just what this has in common with Hope and Glory and Gregory's Girl.
Yeah.
Is that feeling of being a kid at that time.
The accuracy and detail, that was the very first rule. People will be surprised to learn that I've been trained in comedy. But
with a stick and a chair.
I went to a sort of weekend course long before I did stand-up about sitcom, and that was the first thing they drilled into us. And John Sullivan's writing was used as the exemplar of the specific always being funnier than the general. The more specific you can be without descending into pure geekery.
Yeah. His expression that this is about coming of age and also a country coming of age. The idea of we've had the war and the future's coming, and it's expressed in him saying that everyone will speak Esperanto and have their own teas made. Yeah. Esperanto and teas made are the two specific details that tell you when this is happening, and also his class and the things he's read in Look and Learn or whatever.
Yeah.
Which means that from now on, there'll never be any more wars, ever again. For the simple raison d'etre, the United Nations will insist there's no more wars. Any country wants to invade another, the United Nations will vote against it.
You can sense everything about him by him with absolute assurance pronouncing all these things. And one of the lovely things is he goes from complete assurance to complete doubt.
Yeah.
And his coming of age is partly to do with that lovely thing of losing a child's sureness.
Yeah.
And then going, this is complicated.
Arguably, that's where he and the girl meet in the middle, isn't it? After that kind of desire, is that they have to find they've got some space to compromise between the two of them in what the world is really like.
What do you think was the reason?
I don't know.
You don't know much then, do you?
No, I don't. I know nothing. I used to think I knew everything about everything, the world and that, but I don't. Maybe I got it wrong.
Got what wrong?
Everything. Tommy, the world. Maybe it's all lies.
What is?
Everything I thought. About everything.
That is, it's heartbreaking, though, how he tries to convince the groundskeeper that his sacrifices in the war have not been in vain because they've created a brand new, a bold, brave new world, a great new future.
He's reading the Eagle or something.
And on the one hand, he's got all these ludicrously feeble technological advances to cheer him up with. And on the other hand, the groundsman doesn't deserve any of it anyway because it turns out he was a deserter and ran away 3 hours after the war started. Which, again, I was interested in that because I think at the time, and what was it? What are we saying, 1983 or something?
82.
I suppose at the time that was still a fair, there was a degree of moral clarity about being a deserter. I wonder now if you made that now, if people wouldn't have some sympathy with him.
The
idea that the war had been a senseless waste anyway.
There's sympathy for him. I don't read it as something that the writer thinks he should be shamed for. I think he's saying that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. He's not like some scoundrel or cattle bounder who's tried to sort of present himself as a chest full
he's
of
not
medals.
The philanderer.
Yeah, no, exactly.
But he's got this thing where the only person who's built him up to be this war hero is Alan, is the kid. The kid thinks this of him, and the only place he's got to fall from isn't anywhere he's claiming to be. Yeah. It's just that the kid is talking to him, and brilliantly, the groundskeeper just never responds to any of these things, wearily gives the list of theatres of conflict he hasn't been in. But there's no sense of him pretending. He's not going to break that kid's heart. The kid's going to break his own heart.
Yeah, and they're all scared, aren't they? The groundsman was scared of the war. Quack Quack is scared of basically kissing this girl.
The girl
is scared of not being attractive, and Alison Steadman is scared of being both pregnant and found out for having had an affair with the head teacher. I thought we agreed to draw a veil over the war, Henry. After what happened on VJ Day.
VJ Day as well.
Not VE Day. Yes. They waited. Yes. It was proposed on VE Day. She cracked on VJ Day.
Well, he was in Burma, remember? Oh, so, yeah. They didn't know that then, I don't think. But I love, but they are also, the boys are also scared of having got the world and adult life completely wrong as well, aren't they? I think that's what's in there, all their ludicrously sort of Pig Latin type, endless, you know, the Tang Yang Kippa Bang thing is not an isolated example. They're ridiculously verbose.
Osculatory weediosity.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which all sounds like Harry Potter. It's kind of weird.
It does,
very J.K. Rowling. But yeah, they're showing off. They are little boys dressed as men. Mm. And the great thing is that the big hero man turns out to be as scared as them. And it's all about growing up and stepping into masculinity. And the rude mechanicals are just stuff and nonsense. Everyone's got their own version of it. And the cricket commentary, these are heroes. And you think, well, cricket's a game. Games are things that children do. There's the idea of making heroes out of people who've carried on playing. Mm. All of it is very nuanced and very clever and very empathetic to the idea that this is all acting. And he gets to be in a play and act as an old man, as an older man with a false moustache and things. And these kids are beautifully dressed up on stage as grown-ups with all their affairs and philanderings and things. You're thinking, this is a beautiful study, very, very subtle, in the roles people are playing.
And getting the kids to play a play in which the main villain is a philanderer and I no longer a philanderer. You know, what did they can't have understood this, the 13 and 14-year-olds. They wouldn't have known what a philanderer was in 1948, would they? They'd have just known it was basically a bounder of some sort.
It's the wrong play to do.
Whether it's Alison Steadman's character able to channel all her animosity towards such bounders.
There's that run through it, the idea of sort of people playing roles and what masculinity is. And the other thing that runs through it is the word nature again and again.
Yeah.
And the idea that what's going on here is entirely natural. When he treads on the spider and the pregnant spider gives out all its babies, and you go, the first sign, and he says, I've seen a miracle. What a miracle of birth, a miracle of the cycle of nature. If he can't kiss the girl, then humanity is doomed. There is something terrible at stake here, which we all go through. A thing where if you can't get over your awkwardness around the opposite sex, if you are heterosexual and want to have children, if you can't get over it, then there's no more children.
I saw yesterday, ironically, working title movie, and I posted a review on Twitter, so I apologise if anyone's already read it and is going to waste the next 20 seconds, but essentially my point was that perfectly normally for a working title, a late period working title movie, they've taken a fascinating concept, a proposition, a man wakes up from a road accident and is the only one who remembers the songs of the Beatles, absolutely extraordinary, what would the world be like, and then they have focused on perhaps the least interesting aspect of that, which is to say, what would it mean for his non-starter of a relationship with a girl he's known for 20 years and has never so much as kissed yet, which I found disappointing, because the world without the Beatles would not just be a world without the Beatles. You know, they're one of the major. Where Rosenthal is so brilliant is that he does manage to, he can refract the whole world through the tiny microcosm of a burgeoning relationship, and also a little life. All his plays, I would imagine, and this may be a thing a playwright might well say, well, that is what plays are about, but they always seem to be about a transition through life stages. This is about coming of age and to some extent putting away childish things, to some extent accepting some of the compromises and the scales fall from your eyes and some of the gloss wears off of the world. At the other end of stage, he did the Eskimo Walk was one of his, wasn't it? With Maureen Lipman, one of his last ones, in which, you know, old people send their kids off to university and start to wonder what they're going to do with the rest of their lives now they've completed their basic function in nature.
And the Chain, which is a series of people transitioning from one house to another, from one class to
another.
Absolutely. It's about
and
chrysalises.
Sweet Sunday, another Sunday in Sweet F.A. is about a man who idolised Dixie Dean actually taking his opportunity as a ref to head a goal at the end of a match, you know.
What all of these things have in common, which is something which I'm really passionate about, as is my wife, is that this is drama. And drama can be small. And one of the things that's happened to television with the splintering of comedy into comedy and being funded by comedy departments and drama into drama is what you've lost is a drama about small things. A drama that's an hour and 17 minutes long these days, to get funded, would need to have a dead body on a beach at the beginning, have to have terrorists in it and explosions, to have incredibly high stakes. And what's beautiful about these plays, they're all about very low stakes, which you just lean towards slightly, and then suddenly realise they're the highest stakes in the world. When Dr. Foster came out, it was a huge hit. It was because it was just about a marriage was at stake. You don't need to fill an hour enormous globe-shattering drama.
But you do need to write it well, don't you? Yes. You need to write and act it well, because if you've got a screen full of people going, this is my whole life! Yeah. Don't you see how much this matters to
that's
me?
That's bad soap.
Oh, God.
I think it has become the preserve of soap to do individual life dramas. And what's beautiful, this has got a lot in common with Michael Palin's East of Ipswich.
Yes.
Another beautiful play around
that's
the same time.
That's a great play.
Where there's very, very little at stake. But I remembered it forever because it was about a real thing. And the big risk with insisting that drama, two things. One, that drama be high stakes. And two, that drama be long and run to six seasons and things. He was, apparently, Rosenthal was a huge anti-long stories. He didn't like long dramas. He didn't want to write sitcoms. He wanted to write a story, began, middle and end. A slice of people's lives. And they're a blessing to watch.
All good dramas, I think, are, if they're based on anything that's previously existed, it should be a short story, or at the very least a novella. You should never go into a full, you know, there's always too much in a novel.
There's a place for an epic War and Peace thing.
Yes, yes.
But
you've got
what's
to have that
strange
that
is that everything is now supposed to be Tolstoy. It's supposed to be you're supposed to be able to go into someone's life and there'll be so much in there that you'll watch it for eight seasons. There's enough in this for an hour and 17 minutes.
One of the magical things about the smallness of this thing, of course, is that to Quack Quack, this is his entire world that's at stake. He has got to get this girl. He has absolutely got to kiss her. And there's that beautiful speech at the end where he tries to explain to her how he feels about her.
You're beautiful, Anne. Sometimes I look at you and you're so beautiful I want to cry. And sometimes you look so beautiful that it makes me want to laugh and jump up and down and run through the streets with no clothes on, chatting Britannia and Kipperbang in people's letterboxes. But mostly you're so beautiful. Even if it doesn't make me cry, it makes my chest cry.
Yes. And this is how a 13-year-old would try and parse the thing in their head that's going, "What? I'm in love and
this
I can't really say
before.
It. I don't understand this.
When I walk past your desk, I breathe in on purpose to smell your skin. It's the most beautiful smell there is.
It's only Yardley's.
Makes me feel dizzy, giddy. You smell brand new. You look brand new. All of you.
It's always the smell of the girl's hair rather than some more obviously sexualised, you know, characterisation.
Her lips are perfect and then her nape. My nape?
Yes.
The back of your neck.
The back of the neck is termed the nape. termed. He's still at school.
Also, the one thing of her she can't possibly ever have seen.
No.
And also, nape is really telling because it means he sat behind her in class and stared at the back of the neck, and her inaccessibility has been her face. And what he'll have done, if you're sitting behind a girl, you're fantasising about her face. Her actual face, the thing she will have obsessed about in the mirror, having read in magazines what to look like, he's not really thought about. He's incredible. Incredible, beautiful 1940s Puritanism, and also his 13-year-old Puritanism is wonderful in that he won't talk about sex. He calls sex the other thing. He won't even mention it. Mm. It's just about kissing. And one of the things this has got, which I think he gets completely right, is very often when you do a teen sex thing or teen love thing, there's this feeling that children hit a point where they suddenly become sexually active and then become horny, like Porky's or something. And weirdly, most kids are embarrassed. Well, they find it enormously embarrassing. There's a terrific episode of Freaks and Geeks, which is the American series that this has lots in common with, because it's about awkward kids, where they get to see a porn film for the first time. And instead of watching it and going, they slowly back away from it as if they're frightened until it's done in a montage and all you see is their reaction to it. And they're in different corners of the room because they're so frightened of it. And then they say, "We'll never speak of this again." And that's a very Jack Rosenthal moment. And I think that honesty in saying he would not be comfortable with becoming sexual.
No.
He's got that perfect. It's not about that the girl is denying him access to sex that he wants. He is feeling awkward about this. He doesn't want to do the thing he thinks he wants to do.
He wants courtly love, doesn't he, at that point?
Yeah, it's romantic. Really, it's romantic in the sort of 13th century sense.
That's why I've always wanted to kiss you. Ever since 3B. Just kiss. Not the other things. I don't want to do the other things to you.
Possibly he's picked up the vibe from The Groundsman about what can go wrong, you know.
Yeah.
But probably not.
Nature is going on. There's a lovely... they're on a nature walk at some point, and the teacher, the sort of very tall, willowy, sort of slightly starchy Joyce Grenfell-y teacher who's talking about things, and you realise in the background she's talking about reproduction in plants.
Females have clusters around the stalks, and the males globular and pendulous. Duckworth? Well...
I didn't hear the question, miss.
I didn't ask you one.
He's full of... There's fertility everywhere.
Yeah.
The threat that this is the next thing he's going to have to cope with. And he said, "I'll just do kissing and no further."
Yeah.
I will understand and make a mystery of kissing because I don't want to make the next step.
So it's kids who are dealing with the transition into basically adulthood, the early stages of it. And then at the end, they have to dress up as adults and be adults in a play. And it's sort of the opposite of Blue Remembered Hills, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where you've got adults playing kids and Dennis Potter using them as magnifying glasses. But they're all being used as magnifying glasses here as well, aren't they?
I remember the first time I went to big school, genuinely being afraid that if fifth formers were to get into a fight, you know, that one of them might kill the other one.
Like
they were like huge dinosaurs.
Yeah, it's like watching a fight between diggers.
Yeah.
These two diggers, you've got to stand well clear because the equipment, you get caught up in the machinery. Wear a high-vis jacket if fifth formers are fighting. Yes. When they get pulled in.
And then you get to the fifth form and you're lucky if you split someone's lip. You know, with all the sort of.
There was a real
around.
Fear of that. I remember Grange Hill being a terrifying thing to watch before I went to senior school.
Going, again, not watched, not allowed.
If this was what it was going to be like, there's a real feeling that you're being propelled constantly forwards and it's natural and it's good that things are constantly changing. And you get it when you look at your own kids and they start at some point, their knuckles start to go white. Like, can I just stay?
Yeah.
They start getting fascinated with, do you remember when we used to watch Peppa Pig?
Yeah.
Wanted to sort of find the old toys and things. And nostalgia kicks in very, very early, especially when puberty happens. And
this
kind
is
of thing
why,
going,
this
can
is
we
why,
get off the roller coaster?
This is why tribes have a ritual. You have to have a rite of passage. It doesn't just happen. You have to have a physical, memorable break.
Culturally, we need to have a thing with horns and something where you destroy the toys or we smash everything
kicked
up.
Out of a tree, aren't you? I think
it's like a bear.
I remember that one of the single, and not in any joking sense, one of the single most terrifying things I ever learned was that at one of the secondary schools I might be sent to when I was leaving my junior school, a school called Marshallswick School in St Albans. Marshallswick School, it was said that a fight had broken out during the lunch hour in one of the classrooms between two boys, and there'd been a teacher present, but he was so afraid of his own physical safety that he hid under the desk rather than intervene. That remains to this day one of the most frightening scenarios I can imagine.
That Stephen King can make a novel of that.
Yeah, exactly.
The grown-up who was too scared to intervene.
So
you'd have gone to secondary school in the late 70s?
76, I went up.
Then it's perfectly conceivable that that teacher was someone who had fought in World War II and was seriously fucking traumatised.
Might
it could
have
well have been someone who...
Or he might just have been a supply teacher who didn't know the kids and he didn't, you know, not it's above my pay grade.
Or maybe he was burrowing.
Left. Yeah, he might have been.
Building
or just putting
nest.
On his fighting shoes. Yeah. Time he came back up, it was over.
No kicking to be done. But there's a nice sense of this in this, where there are, because they're real kids in it, they're cast the right age, there's a lovely big cast of kids, they've got lovely faces, they're very, very, very of their time, and you can tell their characters, they're beautifully done, and the cast of grown-ups above them, that both of those worlds, the grown-up world and the children's world, are equally lost.
Yeah.
And incompetent, unable to organise themselves. And that the grown-ups are just playing at being grown-ups as well. The attitude of the headmaster to Alison Steadman is of a little moonstruck boy as well.
Seems silly calling me sir when there's no one else in the room.
Please.
I never see you these days, Estelle.
Those days are over. These days aren't those days. The war's been over a long time now.
And all the young men have come marching home again, eh?
I thought we'd agreed to draw a veil over the war, Henry.
And when you find out that the big man, the big hero of the war, isn't a hero of the war and it was all made up, that's the when the illusions fall from his eyes, is when he gets strong. And the thing he has to learn is that no one knows. No one's got this. Which I think is something I'm still learning now.
Yeah.
When you suddenly see politicians and go, oh my God, you're absolutely incompetent. And then you think, but when I was a kid, they were just older than you.
My son, who's now, he'll be 12 at the end of this month, July, he said to me about 2 years ago, unprovoked, he said, I'm just starting to realise that you and Mum are not just my parents. You're like real people for yourselves. Which I couldn't decide if that was actually that's quite an extraordinary insight.
Yeah. Well, that feels like an extension of the thing that happens to children in very, very early development, which is at some point a baby realises that there's a point at which it ends and its mother begins.
Yeah.
And it's the long goodbye, isn't it?
Yeah.
Basically, you know, it's that thing.
And it's very long, that goodbye, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
And object permanence and all those strange things.
But my wife said one of the most haunting things she ever saw was she was looking at some footage that her mum had filmed when she was a student nurse back in the 60s. And it was cine film. And at some point, her mum turned the camera on herself in a full-length mirror and she saw her mum at her age.
Wow.
And she said it still stays with her as a chilling thing. She went, oh, my God, you were me.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, you were a student and you were lost and you didn't know what you were doing. And it was really terrifying and yet thoroughly thrilling.
Yeah.
And this play is, there's a lot of that in this play, of realising that when you realise that the grown-ups are just more children, they are the Blue Remembered Hills kids, they are just dressed up, they've not got this, that the grown-ups you're admiring are a war hero who is not really a war hero, who ran away, who is scared of doing something, like you're scared of doing something, and that your big hero, John Arler, is just talking about some men playing a game that you might play with your friends, that they're not really big.
No, absolutely. I wonder whether people who are attracted to power and capable of seizing it are actually at some level kind of fighting that fear deep down inside, you know. Prime Minister, President of Facebook or whatever, you know, that you've still got, I don't know what this is all, it's all on nothing, isn't it? It's all based on nothing, you know. It's all just a big floating turtle. And there's no sense to any of it at all. Instead of digging a hole, have a stronger grasp.
Yeah, well, there's a feeling of that in a lot of Jack Rosenthal's work, that whoever it is who's making something, who's got their hands dirty, they've got some sense that the horny-handed sons of toil have got an understanding of the real world. So it's the bin men. It's the firemen. Yeah. It's the guys driving the removal truck who've got a real philosophical sense. The cab drivers. And it's the guys digging the hole. It's the guy in Ready When You Are, Mr. McGill, who's painting a long wall. At the end of the day, they've achieved nothing at all in Ready When You Are, Mr. McGill. The film crew have wasted their time making a drama that wasn't worth making, and the extra has fluffed his line and will be cut out. No one's achieved anything, but all the way through it, you've seen a wall being painted. At the end of it, it's undeniable that man painted a wall.
Yeah. The funny thing is, in the two plays that I watched, Kipper Bang and Another Sunday, the exact same operation is being pursued, which is to paint white lines onto sports fields.
That's what the groundsman is doing, and then
there's a fella doing it with
all
the same
you can
truck.
Achieve. Yeah. All we can achieve as human beings is to
make
build
arbitrary
a wall.
Markings on a spot to say this. Everything inside this is the game, and outside of that is not.
Like Stonehenge, what are you going to leave behind? Yes. You'll leave behind a wall, a painting, you'll have moved some stuff from A to B. Yeah. Physical work is all that's really admirable. Yes.
Which is the great anxiety of a playwright, I suppose.
Maybe that's it. He's expressing...
My father has always said, he's 89 now and has kept his sanity remarkably well, and he has always said that you need to have a hobby where you use both your hands and ideally, you know, cross them over at some point or into you know... They have to work with one another. So skipping, for instance, won't do it. He builds model aeroplanes, does pottery, has made paper and turning things on a lathe and stuff. But he says this is the only way to restore your sanity. At the end of the day, when you spend all day in your head, you need to bring everything back to what you can do with your hands. This is, and you know, it just in terms of the evidence in front of my eyes, it seems to have kept him going. I think there's something to be said for that.
This film, particularly this play, is about someone who's living in their mind, is living in there, and it's about him. It's clearly autobiographical in places. It's very, very heartfelt.
Weirdly, in his autobiography, he spends about a page and a quarter on it, and none of it is to do with the background of it. He doesn't talk about where it came from. Whereas obviously something like Bar Mitzvah Boy, which is nakedly autobiographical, he could talk about that. I mean, he made a whole documentary based around it, but this hardly gets a mention
maybe
for some reason.
Maybe he said everything about this period in this play.
Yeah, maybe.
This is what it felt like to be a little boy on the verge of that. And there's a feeling in it of what's happening to these boys of this generation, maybe. I mean, what's happening to the boys of this generation is that they are being given this new world. The war has been won. It's 1948. What are you going to do with it? And he's going, world peace. And this is it's my responsibility to step up to the plate and make good with what I've been given by the heroes who've done this for me. These great men, and it's men, it's always men. These great men, what they have done, I've got this to step in, and I'm too frightened to hold a girl's hand. Am I really a man? Who am I? And then the answer is that wasn't his job. That you feel the weight of expectation on them, and yet it's telling this story in such a small way. And maybe what we are remembering, loving about this, and why it is still beautiful to watch, is that it's a really small story about a really big thing. Big moment in this kid's life, and a big moment in history. What was this generation going to do? And the answer was, they were kind of still quite timid and still quite childlike. And if you were going to say, what were the baby boomers like? Yeah. They were a bit like this.
He wasn't going to smash it out for a six at the last moment. It was a quick single.
Yeah.
That was enough.
This is after The Greatest Generation.
Yeah.
And the answer is, what are you going to do? Well, to be honest, it probably wasn't as good as building a wall or digging a hole.
But it is all lovely. There's a sunniness about it, isn't it? You know, it's a beautifully sunny film, and the uniforms are all yellow and green. So they're all in, colours of fertility, the thing you mentioned mentioned earlier, you know. So obviously it was, it's from a time of great optimism.
It was convalescence, wasn't it, I suppose, after the war?
Yeah, I suppose so, yes.
Healing. I often think convalescence is the single happiest state to be in. I don't know if you've ever had that moment where you realise you're not going to die. Everyone has it on a really bad hangover. It's probably the most frequent, you know.
Four in the afternoon.
It suddenly it just lifts half a pound of weight from
humanity
your
at its best. We got through the war.
I made
it. We got
it.
Through it. Yeah. It's
I
got,
made it.
It has got that feeling of new life about it, which I think maybe that's what we're tapping into.
The spiders.
Yeah, the nostalgia for this is going, I remember when it was terrifying that so much was about to happen.
Yeah.
And it's a lovely feeling to dip into and to go, well, I got there, I survived.
Yeah.
And so did he. Everything's about to come and you don't know whether you're going to make it, but there's this hope.
Yeah, yeah. He goes to the wicket a boy and comes back a man, doesn't he? You know,
it's beautiful.
What a beautiful moment to end. Thank you so much for bringing Jack Rosenthal and Patangan Kipperbank, Simon.
Thank you very much for inviting
me. Thank
you,
Simon.
And Duckworth and Duckworth and Duckworth has done it. He glances as the ball calmly past Fine Short Leg for a single. England have won the most dramatic victory in the history of cricket. And for that record-breaking 365 not out that won it, the entire crowd, and I'll wager the entire nation, rises to its feet in homage to Quack Quack Duckworth, who went to the wicket a boy and came back a man.
He'll be starting shaving next.
Then spending the rest of his life trying to stop the bleeding.